Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. There's a new book out that's being devoured by people fascinated with Boston politics and its complicated, storied, and often messy history. It's the much-awaited memoir by former Boston Mayor Tom Menino, who's now 71 years old and stepped down earlier this year after 20 years in office.
His new book is called Mayor for a New America, and it covers his rise from an obscure political aide from Hyde Park to the city's longest-serving mayor. It's co-written with political analyst Jack Beatty, who's the author of another book about another famous Boston mayor, The Rascal King, The Life and Times of James Michael Curley.
Menino's memoir begins near the end of his tenure as he's shepherding the city through one of the most traumatic incidents in its history, the Boston Marathon bombings.
The very first words of the book's introductions, quote, part of this speech Menino gave at an interfaith service 3 days after the attack.
I'm telling you, nothing can defeat the heart of the city. Nothing. Nothing will take us down because we take care of one another. Even with the smell of a smoke in the air and blood on the streets, tears in our eyes, we triumphed over that hateful act on Monday afternoon.
Mayor Menino was scheduled to be with us here in the studio, but we got word just as the show was beginning that a very bad case of laryngitis is going to prevent him from meeting with us. He's been in New York the past few days for meetings and to talk about his book. But we have with us Menino's co-author, Jack Beatty. Jack, always good to have you on the air.
Thank you, Sasha.
And Jack, I want to ask you first a process question, so a more narrow question about how you went about this. So you, as we mentioned, have written a book about a mayor before, a very different one than this mayor. But tell us how the process worked and how you communicated with Menino, how the two of you worked together to create this book.
Sure. Well, he was very generous with his time and his aides and friends and supporters were generous with theirs. So I talked to him a lot, and I talked to them a lot, and he would give me an answer that I would then go to some of his aides and get more information about, and they would tell me things that I would then go to him about, and he could add more information, fill out the picture. So it was a kind of iterative process, back and forth, lots of dialogue, and if the mayor said anything to me about what should go into the book, it was just simply tell the truth. Uh-huh. I don't know. You know, he didn't make claims that didn't have some validity, and he didn't want the book to just simply be your typical memoir where the candidate basically is the greatest thing that ever happened to American politics. He wanted grounded. He wanted examples. If I move the city, give me an example of how I move the city. If the city is more tolerant, give me an example. If I built buildings, how many? That's the kind of thing. He wanted the book to have some credibility.
Your last book, or your book about James Michael Curley, was about a very different kind of mayor. You know, he was big and brash and bombastic. He ended up in prison. You know, I'm wondering if you can sort of compare the process of writing about that mayor with writing about this one.
Well, that was a depressing job. Strangely enough, the Curley archive, such as it is, and 600 scrapbooks, really, these big books, is out at Holy Cross College, and I'd go out there on weekends and just be going through this stuff, and I just felt increasingly depressed, because Curley was a man of the people, and he did genuinely want to help people. I think of people like my parents struggling in the Depression. At the same time, he wanted to help himself. And I just couldn't get over that. I just couldn't get over the Chesterfield collar coats, the velvet this, the lobster that, the vacations here, the Persian rugs, the Oriental objet d'art. Objet d'art? What the hell is that? I mean, why did this man have to feel he had to live so well not on the public payroll, hardly, but on honest graft. That is, I'll connect you with your opportunities, a city contract, and in return, you'll give me some money.
You're making me think, Jack, how much that contrasts with who Menino identifies as his political hero, Harry Truman. He says that he considered him a plain-spoken man of the people, and Menino writes that that's how he felt he was and wanted to be as well.
Yes, and what a contrast. Harry Truman was in a haberdashery business in Kansas City after the war. The business went bankrupt. As you know, the bankruptcy laws essentially say you don't have to pay off your creditors. That wasn't Harry Truman. It took him years and years and years, bits and pieces out of his salary. He paid off every cent. And when I'd say that, and when my father, who raised me on that story, would say, and he paid off every cent, I'd say, well, why, Dad? Why? He said, why? Because of his name. Because Harry Truman had to mean something. That's the difference between James Michael Curley. He didn't care about his reputation.
Listeners, we're talking with Jack Beattie, the co-author with former Boston Mayor Tom Menino of the new Menino memoir, Mayor for a New America. If you have questions about Menino's tenure, if you'd like to talk with Jack about the book and about the process of writing the book and his experience, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Jack Beattie, as we mentioned, Menino's memoir begins with the Boston Marathon. I think it's noteworthy that he starts with an episode that happened near the very end of his tenure in office. And, you know, in many ways, especially in the days immediately after the marathon, it was a real time of solidarity for Boston. And Menino writes about that, about the one fund coming together so quickly with the help of people like Mike Sheehan at Hill Holiday and John Hancock, CEO Jim Gallagher, writing a $1 million fund. You know, the fund had $7.5 million in it in the first 24 hours. And I wonder if, as you talked with Menino about that experience, did it feel to you that it felt like sort of the culmination of everything he had learned in office coming together as he rallied people, brought together city leaders and power brokers to make this happen? Did it feel like a culminating event in his mind?
I think that's very fair. I think it did. He wouldn't put it quite that grandly, but it fit his... for one thing, he had to come from someplace. He was in a hospital bed. He had just had surgery for a broken leg. He was in pain. He was taking painkillers. The doctors didn't want him to leave the hospital. He said, no way, I'm out of here. And that is, I think, typical of the mayor that the people knew and loved. When he... In his last months, there was a headline, Menino more popular than kittens.
right. He went out with approval rating in the 80% range.
Yeah.
Right?
His modus vivendi as a mayor was to be there, to be on the scene, to show up, to show solidarity with suffering people, with sports teams, with Little League, with anybody, and basically to say, you live in this city, you're special, I'm here to say you're special. And I think he just had to get in and get involved and show the people, even through pain and gritted teeth, that he was still on the scene. And he made some really important contributions to the effort to calm the city down, to assure people that there was going to be maximum security, but not to interrupt their daily lives, and to just sort of give a tone of, we're taking care of this. And I think they trusted him from long experience to know that he was doing everything to make sure his people were doing that.
And that tone you reference, he really elaborates on that, that he felt like the attitude he needed to project had to be very deliberate. You know, he didn't want to delay with providing public information because rumor might fill that vacuum. He didn't want to frighten
exactly.
people by declaring a state of emergency. He felt that government needed to act calmly and confidently. Did you also get that sense in talking with him that he thought very carefully about what he needed to present when he talked to the public about this event?
I think his persona was one of dignity, of we're concerned, we are not afraid, and you don't have to be afraid. And, you know, he didn't want an overreaction. At one of the earliest meetings, if not the earliest, they had at the Westin Hotel the afternoon of the bombing, when he got there in his bad leg and all, his wheelchair. There was some suggestion from one of the governor's people to security people to say maybe we need a state of emergency. He said, no way. That's just the wrong message to send. That will create panic. And he was also thinking about, you know, what about people who just happen to be Muslim or look, you know, or wearing during after 9/11, Sikhs, people with turbans were being pulled over and in some cases, or at least one case, murdered. He didn't want any of that. He wanted tolerance. He wanted confidence. He wanted to tamp down fear. At the same time, he was pushing, let's find the people who did this.
You mentioned, Jack, that at the time this happened, Mayor Menino was going through a pretty tough period in terms of his health. He was in a wheelchair at the time. And he writes that he usually tried to let comments from the media in particular roll off his back. But someone, I think it was a local academic, had made a comment that it's too bad that the public's lasting memory of Menino in that time would be of him in a wheelchair. And he said that really bothered him to the extent that he forced himself to get out of that wheelchair and stand up before a lectern when he spoke at an interfaith service. How much has it bothered him to be physically limited by his health issues?
Oh, I think it was a tremendous frustration to him because, as I say, his bond with the voters was being out there. I mean, one poll, I think in 2009, found that nearly 50% of the population of Boston had met him at one time or another. I mean, think of that. He'd shaken the hands of half the population. And he thought that was the basis of his bond with the voters. It also energized him. You know, he'd be out meeting people. They'd be telling him about the small things that had to be got right. Mayor, that stoplight, it's not working. Or you know what, the trash is. He would make sure that was done. It was part of his feedback from the voters. He couldn't go out there through that last couple of years because of these multiplicity of injuries. He couldn't go out, and when he did go out, it would be on his cane, and people would not want to get too close to him for fear they would push him over, and it just made him feel tremendously frustrated.
In fact, it was so important for him to be out and about a lot that he writes at one point in the book that he doesn't even drink coffee, but he was still a regular at Dunkin' Donuts because
that
was such a great place to meet people.
Absolutely, absolutely true.
I'm talking with Jack Beatty, the co-author with former Boston Mayor Tom Menino of Menino's new memoir, Mayor for a New America. If you have questions about the mayor for Jack Beatty, give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let me go to Amber, who's calling from Wenham. Amber, your thoughts about Mayor Menino and his memoir, if you've been able to read it or any reviews of it?
I haven't read it, but I'm so glad you're talking about him today. My family we are survivors of the Boston Marathon bombing, and I just remember it was maybe a month after it happened, he had a mayor's dinner, and we all got together. And he was in his wheelchair, and my husband was in his wheelchair, and several other people. And he just made us feel so, like, blessed and just so warm, but he was on our side. And I feel I'm just so grateful to him. And I'm glad I got on the phone so I could, you know, hopefully he hears this and he can hear that I am so thankful.
Amber.
And also, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, and also Barbara Thorpe at the Boston Public Health. I mean, he worked with them and the One Fund, and it's just amazing what he did for us.
Amber, I think you've described so much sort of his signature, sort of his style. And Jack, I think that's captured very much in the book. He writes about how much he cared about those things.
Yes, and not just cared, you know, in the abstract, but did something about it. Within hours of this happening, he was organizing that One Fund, and if I'm not mistaken, every dime raised of at one point it was $10 million, and it's maybe much higher by now. Every dime has gone into to the settlement, to helping people cope with their lives, he was insistent. We have to have one fund. We don't want to have competition here. We don't want to have, people. We don't want any uncertainty about this. We don't want people suspecting, well, maybe this money isn't going to the right people. And he also did something else when he met with groups of people who'd been injured or their families had suffered from this. He said, I didn't make any speeches to these people. You know, they didn't want to hear me make speeches.
Right, he says that. I remember him writing that. They don't want to hear me say, I'm sorry this happened to you. They just want help. So his goal
exactly.
was to help people.
Exactly. We're here to help. We're here to help. And he did that going through he and Senator Warren went at the Brigham Women's Hospital, went from room to room. And he said, you know, it was a stark experience. The young women got younger with each room, and their injuries seemed to get worse. And yet, he said, they were, one of them in particular, was trying to cheer us up. And he said, you know, you have to be worthy of people like that, not by trying to take advantage of them by making speeches, but by holding their hand and saying, we want to help.
Jack, we have another caller. This is David calling from Jamaica Plain. And David, your thoughts about Mayor Tom Menino and his new memoir?
Yeah, hi. I have not read the book yet. I love the mayor. As a person, he was amazing. But Jack, I'm kind of wondering, I don't know whether he billed himself or the press billed him as the education mayor. And I always got the sense that he felt frustrated by progress or the lack of progress in the Boston public schools. Can you speak at all to that and whether he thought there was progress, what, if anything, he was proud of in the education field? I know that, like, in 2012, he made a big deal out of Madison Park High School being a centerpiece of the education system in Boston, and we know it's been in the Globe for the last couple of months because it's falling apart. I just wanted to get your sense of what Tom Menino thought his progress was or his contribution was in the education.
David, thank you for that question. It's a good one. In fact, there was the lengthy chapter on that. Jack, tell us about that one.
Yes, the struggle for the schools. Well, the mayor, in the second year in office, went to the Jeremiah Burke High School in Dorchester and said, judge me harshly. Judge me harshly if I have not improved these schools. He was the first Boston mayor in a century to have control over the schools. Before Menino, the school committee was elected. Under Menino, beginning with him, it was appointed with his people primarily. He had responsibility. And by gosh, did he try hard to deliver. The average tenure for a school superintendent is something like 3 years. One of his supers was on for 10 years, the other for 6. Unheard of. He said, I want to give these people time to try out their ideas, to get feedback, to improve them, to go on, and I'll take the political heat for them. And he did. He stood up to the politics of impatience. You know, why aren't the schools better, Mr. Mayor? Why can't you do it better? And, you know, he will say immediately, I will not stand for anybody running down the Boston public schools. They have improved. The numbers are real. Are they, you know, as good as the Belmont schools? No, this is the United States of America, the United States of inequality. That's not possible. But movement, progress, demonstrated in the numbers, in the MCAS tests and so on, by gosh, they moved a long way, and he doesn't want any graduate of the Boston public schools to feel inferior.
And we should note here that he calls himself a C student who didn't go to college until his daughter went. So this is very personal for him, that every people should get an education, no matter how old or from where they are.
Yes, and he says, and I understand, who better than me, somebody who understands the importance of education and what it means not to have it, who better than me to lead a movement to improve the schools?
Jack, earlier in the show, we were talking about Boston's housing challenges. It's often very expensive for people to live here, hard to find any place they can afford. And he addresses at one point the fact that one of his goals was always that everyone have the good life he felt that he had in Boston growing up in Hyde Park, always sure he could get a union job, even if he didn't have an education. And he says he sometimes asks himself, did the mayors who transformed Boston, including him, succeed too well? Do you feel that he feels some sense of responsibility that things have gotten so good for some people that others have fallen behind?
I think he does, and I think precisely for what your interviews were bringing out, that middle-class people are squeezed out of this city. The city has become so attractive to empty-nest suburbanites, to, you know, high-tech people coming in, that neighborhood people are being pushed out. That's a reality, and that bothered him. You know, he wondered, would someone like his father be able to rise in Boston? His father was a foreman at the Westinghouse Mouse Factory. Would he be able to rise in the future, Boston, a kind of straight-ahead, plugging guy who, you know, did his job
lunch
and didn't complain?
Lunch pail guy, he calls him.
I mean, could people like that progress in this new city? And it worries him. And there is a new Boston. It is glittery. The New York Times said he's presided over one of the great urban renaissances in modern American history, presided over and is in part responsible for, the Times said. And yet at the same time, it worries him that the squeeze is on for affordable housing and for a decent life. He thinks, you know, he looks at a house on Beacon Hill paying, I think it was $10 million house. Yes, and paying $60,000 a year in real estate taxes. And he says, you know, Beacon Hill doesn't want anything for that $60,000. I take that money and I spend it on parks in Southie and Dorchester and Mattapan. I spend it on things for kids. And in a way, what he's saying is I leverage economic inequality to bring up social equality, to make it so that in Boston you don't have to be rich to live a rich life.
Jack, among people who've been able to get their hands on the book, one theme of what people felt unsatisfied by was they wanted more of a sense of his personal passage from that inconspicuous political aide to a great urban mayor. Did you get a sense? Did you try to draw that more out of him, or do you think he felt satisfied with the amount of personal that he included?
Well, I think that, he's a dignified man. And, politicians often aren't. They're sort of shameless and thespians in a way. They'll perform whatever this isn't that kind of guy. He's genuinely reserved. And I think the story, there's a lot in there that tells you how he triumphed. And he himself says his parents are the reason. The values they taught him are the values he lived by, and those are the ones that were rewarded. Work hard, treat everyone with respect, help other people, provide for your family. You know, you do those things in life, and you're not going to go too far wrong. And to that, I think he added something else, and that's compassion. None of that's faked. It's real. And I think there is the secret right there of his rise, not some magic sauce, but simply the right values and the right heart.
Jack, in about the minute we have left with you, I just want to summarize a question that a listener is hoping to ask. And that's how did Mayor Menino feel that he changed throughout his time as mayor?
Gosh. I think he realized that government can do something for people. He called himself a Hubert Humphrey New Deal Democrat. Government's in the business of helping people. And I don't think he ever lost sight of that. But what I do think is that he got better at it. And he demanded more of his team. And people were fired because they didn't deliver. You know, he said, the public expects great performance from me all the time. I expect it from my people at least some of the time. And so he wanted to deliver. He wanted right to the end to make government work. It's that consistency I'm struck with. And by gosh, look at today when government just doesn't seem to work. We need that message so much.
That's Jack Beatty, co-author with former Mayor Tom Menino of Menino's new memoir, Mayor for a New America. Jack, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And stay with us coming up. If you're trying to break some bad habits, you may be interested in a new wearable device that will shock you into submission. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.